The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
There's no doubt about it. It's well mobilized, it's well funded, it's well organized. And there's no hiding from the issue. Marriage is, we hear the term marriage is under assault, but really the definition is in play. Something that probably has happened before in society, but I don't think ever in that concerted way, in a way that is so focused to say, let's take what marriage is and not just change a word here or there or tweak the definition, but to fundamentally change the definition. But before we can respond to that, don't we have to get a clear definition of what marriage is in the first place? I think we do. Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, the 14th of January. Joining us for a defense of natural marriage, Dr. Robert George. He's visiting professor at the Harvard Law School and professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. He's a former member of the President's Council on Bioethics and co-author of the new book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. Dr. George, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's great to be back on the show.
You say that once the state decides to recognize marriage at all, it has an obligation, the state that is, to get marriage right. Why is that?
It's because marriage is so critical to the flourishing of society. That, in turn, is because marriage is so fundamental to the well-being of children. If human beings didn't reproduce sexually, no one would have come up with the idea of marriage in the first place. But the reality is that human beings do reproduce sexually, and our young aren't born the way sharks are, already ready to take on the world, and they swim away, and the parents don't need to bother with them anymore. Young human beings come into the world in a highly dependent state and require 18, 21 years of nurture before we can really put them off on their own. So marriage is the uniquely apt social arrangement for the rearing of children. It ensures that children will be brought up in the context of a loving and committed bond between mother and father, each making the distinctive contributions that men and women do as parents. So if you understand that the law has an essential interest in marriage, quite unlike any interest that it could conceivably have in baptisms or bar mitzvahs or in ordinary friendships where the state really has no legitimate interest. But when you understand that the law has a critical interest in marriage and in a healthy marriage culture, and when you understand that marriage is not fundamentally about adult satisfactions, it's not a matter of sexual romantic companionship or domestic partnership, but when you understand that marriage is an institution that is shaped by its aptness for child-rearing, that it's naturally ordered to the good of having children and it's naturally fulfilled by having children when a marriage is fortunate enough to be blessed with children. When you understand all that, you'll see that the definition of marriage as a conjugal union, that is, as a partnership of man and woman, husband and wife, is just essential.
Now, you use the term there, and you and your co-authors use it throughout the book, a conjugal definition of marriage. Would you explain that in a little more detail?
Yes. Historically, in the Jewish and Christian traditions, but not only in the Jewish and Christian traditions, and in Western law and philosophy, but not only in Western law and philosophy, in the Eastern traditions as well, We've always understood marriage to be the coming together of husband and wife in a bond that is distinctively shaped by its aptness for the bringing up of children. It's a bond that is founded upon the bodily union of husband and wife, the union that is effectuated, that's initially consummated, which is actualized in sexual reproductive acts that have their meaning in that context, their full meaning, whether or not the non-behavioral conditions of procreation happen to obtain. That's why historically marriages have been regarded as consummated once the marital act has been performed. We didn't wait until a child was conceived or a child was born to declare a marriage to be consummated. It was consummated by that bodily communion of husband and wife, a bodily communion that's made possible precisely because of the sexual reproductive complementarity of male and female. So what the conjugal understanding of marriage is, the historical understanding of marriage as a conjugal union, is it's a comprehensive sharing of life. That is, not merely an emotional bond, a union of hearts and minds, which any ordinary friendship or form of companionship would be, but as a union of hearts and minds combined with bodily union. Indeed, a union of hearts and minds founded on the bodily communion of husband and wife. Bodily communion, again, made possible by our complementarity as sexual beings. Now, you can see that clearly again when you consider that when we speak of human beings, we're not talking about disembodied spirits or even about spirits or minds or consciousnesses or centers of emotion that merely inhabit and use bodies as if bodies were extrinsic instruments. No, no, no. Our bodies are part of the personal reality of the human being. Our bodies are not mere plumbing. Sexuality is not merely about how you arrange the plumbing. That misunderstanding of the body as a mere extrinsic instrument of the person is at the heart of the misunderstanding of marriage today and of sexuality more generally. Once we restore our understanding of the human person as bodily and not merely as emotional and conscious, as bodily, as a bodily creature, the body fully sharing in the personal reality of the human being, then you can see that marriage, in its very essence, is a male-female union, a bodily union made possible by the complementarity of male and female.
And if you would, what is the opposing view that not so much that we're reacting to, but that we're preparing to defend against? You call it the revisionist view. How would you characterize that?
Yeah. Contrast the conjugal understanding of marriage as essentially a bodily as well as emotional or spiritual union. Contrast that with the idea of marriage or of civil partnership or domestic partnership as merely a form of sexual romantic companionship. On the revisionist understanding of marriage, the understanding that would have to be in place if you accepted the idea that two persons of the same sex could truly be married, or that more than two persons, three persons or five persons in a polyamorous sexual ensemble could truly be married, To accept that kind of view means to accept the idea that what marriage fundamentally is an emotional union, not a bodily one. And that would only make sense if what is in fact not true were true, and that is that our bodies are mere extrinsic instruments and sexuality is merely a matter of how we arrange the plumbing. Once you've adopted that dualistic conception of human beings as non-bodily persons, spirits or consciousnesses or centers of emotion, inhabiting non-personal bodies, then you've paved the way for the complete destruction of the idea of marriage as a conjugal union. You will naturally accept the idea that, of course, two persons of the same sex could be married, but the logical implications of that idea as well, including the belief that marriage can be three persons or five persons in polyamorous sexual partnerships. So those are the two views that are on offer here. We've got to choose as a culture, as a society. There's no alternative to choosing. This is not something that can be simply left to individuals. We will choose as a society whether to honor the historic conjugal understanding, which again was not merely the view of Christianity and Judaism, but of Plato and Aristotle and Xenophanes and Musonius Rufus and Plutarch, all the way up to Gandhi. You know, great thinkers and great people who had no connection with the Jewish or Christian tradition will either honor that or will abandon that, will jettison that in favor of a redefined understanding of marriage as merely a form of especially intense or prioritized sexual romantic companionship, not different in kind, different only in intensity from other kinds of friendship or companionship. And once we do that, Todd, something else follows, and that is we lose any rational basis, any principled basis for the norms that have traditionally been associated with marriage, like exclusivity, fidelity, the pledge and aspiration to the permanence of the union. Because once marriage is simply a matter of romantic, emotional union, then there's no reason in principle why three or five people can't be married together, as polyamorists would have it. There's no reason why marriages have to be sexually closed as opposed to open. Open marriages would make sense on that view. There's no reason for marriage to even aspire to permanence. It could be a temporary thing for as long as emotion sustains it. Everything about marriage collapses, not just the idea that marriage is a union of husband and wife.
So in other words, to say that marriage is merely, and the state's recognition of it or sanction of it, whatever it may be, is that what they are, what the state has an interest in is basically just kind of friendship on steroids, love,
yeah,
romance.
Which, of course, makes no sense at all. The state has no particular interest in romance for romance's sake. I'll tell you why the state has. Let me put it to you very simply, Todd, why state has an interest in marriage. When a baby's born, it's a pretty good bet that there's going to be a mother somewhere nearby, somewhere in the vicinity. Nature provides for that. What nature does not provide for, the real question will be, will there be a father somewhere in the vicinity, a father who will help that mother to bring up that child in a bond of commitment and love between the mother and father, so that the child will have the benefit of the distinctive contributions of father and of mother. Nature doesn't provide for that. If that's provided, it's provided by culture. And when culture makes institutional provision for that, to encourage that, to maximize the odds that the child will be brought up in the mother-father bond, in the husband-wife bond, there's a name for that, and we call that marriage. Once we've abandoned that basic understanding, there's no justification or reason whatsoever for the state to concern itself with marriage any more than the state concerns itself with baptisms or bar mitzvahs or ordinary friendships.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Robert George, a defense of natural marriage. One of the questions that is naturally follows from this is, there are those who say, well, that's the way it should be. The state should have no interest in any of this whatsoever. However we define marriage, we'll get his response to that right after this.
To this conclusion, love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage.
South Africa.
China.
Germany.
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world? India.
Sweden. Egypt.
France. Turkey.
Japan. Australia.
Canada. United Kingdom.
Hong Kong. Austria.
Finland. Malaysia.
Singapore. Bulgaria.
Korea. Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines.
Mexico.
Spain.
New Zealand. Kuwait.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Life, a service of word and music, is scheduled for Sunday, January 20th, 3 p.m. at Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The joint choirs of Village Lutheran Ladue and Reformation Lutheran Afton will join with soloists and congregational singing and a sermon by the Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison in Extolling Life. The offering will benefit Lutherans for Life and Vitae Foundation, who will speak at a reception following the service. Join us for Life, a service of word and music.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking about the defense of natural marriage. Dr. Robert George is our guest. He's visiting professor at Harvard Law School and professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University, former member of the President's Council on Bioethics, and co-author of the new book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. You can purchase this book at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. George, how do you respond to kind of the a libertarian argument that would say, look, the answer to this is the state should have no interest whatsoever in any of these arrangements. These are private arrangements. The state should keep its nose out of it.
I'd say that's insane. Marriage is of interest to the state. It's critical interest to the state. It's regulated by law. It's promoted by law for the simple reason that marriage is the original and best Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. No governmental institution, for that matter, no other non-governmental institution can provide what the family, based on marriage, at its best, is designed to provide, and that is an environment in which children can grow up to be basically honest, decent, hardworking, conscientious, honorable human beings. Nobody's perfect, but we see from historical experience, we see from contemporary sociology, that where marriage and the family break down, where families fail to form, where families dissolve, where there are large numbers of children born out of wedlock, the consequences for those children and for those communities and for society generally are catastrophic. If you want to preserve limited government, which our libertarian friends say they want to do, and I agree with them, if you want to preserve the ideal of limited government, you've got to uphold the role of the family, because once the family breaks down, all those social pathologies that come in the train of family breakdown, the collapse of the marriage culture, all of those social pathologies, drug abuse, addiction, delinquency, violence, despair, all of that, the burden will fall on somebody, and that somebody will inevitably be the state. So the state will have to expand, intrude further and further into civil society in order to provide social services, those health, education and welfare benefits that the family naturally and properly provides, expansion of government, expansion of taxation for those reasons, and the state will have to expand to provide the policing and other security that are necessary as a result of the social pathologies that come with the collapse of family and the marriage culture. So it's just crazy to suppose that the state has no interest in the family or in marriage, or that marriage is simply a private contract. Sure, each marriage individually is a private relationship, but those relationships have profound public consequences, which is why historically marriage is not treated the way we treat bar mitzvahs or baptisms or ordinary friendships, as purely private matters into which the state does not venture. No, on the contrary. The state understands the importance, or historically has understood the importance, of recognizing marriages, distinguishing the marital from the non-marital, of promoting marriage, and of regulating marriage.
How do you respond to someone who says what we're really arguing for is not so much a redefinition, but a broadening of the definition of marriage? It's usually made from kind of a conservative standpoint. We're trying to bring marriage values to all these alternate relationships.
We have no principled reason for once you've redefined marriage as simply a form of sexual, romantic, domestic partnership, there's no principled basis for those marital norms that we've traditionally subscribed to, for fidelity, exclusivity. There's no argument that can be made against open marriages. There's no argument that can be made for marriage being a union of two persons and not three or four or more in a polyamorous sexual partnership. There's no argument for the permanence of marriage. If it's all about adult romance, then there's no principled basis for any of the norms traditionally associated with marriage. No basis for the idea of marriage as an opposite sex or husband-wife partnership, but also an equally no basis for the norms about exclusivity or monogamy or permanence or anything else.
What would be, if you...
And by the way, let me just interrupt to say, Todd, this is not just something that I am saying or something that people on the conservative side of the marriage debate are saying. If you look at the literature of people in the vanguard of the movement to redefine marriage, they say exactly the same thing, only they think that would be a great thing. They don't want simply to eliminate the norm of sexual complementarity as essential to marriage. They want to undermine the norms of fidelity and exclusivity. They see nothing wrong with multiple partner relationships or their legal recognition as marriages. They welcome those because they think that the traditional understanding of marriage as sexually exclusive, as closed, as limited to two people, is a bad thing. So we agree on the consequences of redefining marriage as a sexual, romantic, domestic partnership as opposed to a conjugal union. We just disagree about whether those consequences are good or bad. But both sides see quite clearly this means changing everything.
What are the consequences to religious liberty?
Devastating. And on this, we need no speculation. We can already look at where marriage has been redefined in those states and other jurisdictions in foreign countries where marriage has been redefined to see that immediately anti-discrimination laws are used as weapons to enforce this new sexual orthodoxy on anyone who dissents, including religious people and even religious institutions. So in the state of Massachusetts, after it adopted same-sex marriage by judicial fiat in that state, it was imposed by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. And in the state of Illinois, where civil unions were put into place by the legislature, legally recognized same-sex civil unions, we saw immediately Catholic charities in both states driven out of adoption after providing for decades and decades good homes for orphaned children. The Catholics are driven out of adoption services because, of course, consistently with their Catholic Christian faith, they cannot place children in same-sex-headed households. They place children only in households where they'll have a mom and a dad. But that wasn't good enough. They were given no exemption, even though they requested one. What happens is the belief in marriage as a conjugal union, the belief that children do best when they have a mom and a dad, gets recategorized now as a form of bigotry. And the consequences are that we impose all sorts of civil disabilities on bigots. We don't put them in jail. We have a First Amendment that protects their right to free speech. But we can drive them out in terms of licensing, accreditation, other forms of official recognition and cooperation. So we're only beginning to see, but we're seeing very clearly already, the consequences for liberty of conscience and for religious freedom of redefining marriage. We take a hard line against bigots in this country. And once Christians and Jews and other believers, Muslims, who believe in conjugal marriage are redefined as bigots, they will pay a heavy price.
Can you give us a two-minute response to the one that we often hear, and that is, if you insist upon a conjugal definition of marriage, you're essentially saying that infertile heterosexual couples can't be defined as married either? About a minute and a half for a response?
Socrates, Plato, Musonius, Rufus, Aristotle, Xenophanes, Plutarch, all the way through Gandhi, people with no connection to the Christian faith or to biblical faith, all understood that marriage was consummated by acts that fulfill the behavioral conditions of procreation, even where the non-behavioral conditions don't apply. And that's because we don't merely inhabit our bodies are part of the personal reality of ourselves. So the bodily union that's made possible by sexual reproductive complementarity truly unites persons at all levels, effectuating, in the first case, consummating their marriage and effectuating their marriage, actualizing their marriage, fulfilling their marriage, even if the gift of children doesn't come. The relationship remains one that's naturally oriented toward marriage and would be toward children and would be fulfilled by having and rearing children together, even if children for this particular couple are not possible because of some impediment causing infertility. There's your minute and a half.
And with about 30 seconds, what do you mean when you write redefining civil marriage would change its meaning for everyone? With about 30 seconds, Dr. George.
Yeah, it means that you're choosing not to expand marriage. You're choosing to change the meaning of it. Instead of a relationship naturally oriented toward and that would be fulfilled by having children together, it's redefined as sexual, romantic, domestic partnership, different from other forms of companionship, only intensity and not as a matter of kind. That changes the meaning of marriage for absolutely everybody and will make it impossible for us to restore the healthy marriage culture that began to be damaged with the rise of divorce and cohabitation in the sexual revolution of the 1960s. We need to hold the line on the definition of marriage and win that battle, not for its own sake, but so that we can live to fight to restore the marriage culture so desperately needed, especially for poor and vulnerable communities who have been devastated by the sexual revolution and the breakdown of marriage, but for the whole country as well.
January 22nd marks the 40th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision. With about 30 seconds, your thoughts on 40 years of legalized abortion in the United States?
Our profound sadness at the loss of literally tens of millions of human lives to the great tragedy of abortion should not obscure from our minds the fact that the witness of pro-life people, Protestants and Catholics, Orthodox Jews, increasingly people from the Muslim community, sometimes people of no faith at all, that witness has saved many, many, many lives. We've made great progress. We've kept our movement alive. More Americans are now pro-life than any time since Roe versus Wade. Young people are moving in the pro-life direction. They're more pro-life than their parents. So we need to take heart from that, even in our sadness, and we have to recognize that just as the abolitionists vowed that they would remain in the fight until the field was won and slaves were freed and slavery was abolished, we will remain in this fight until the field is won with this great mission of love and compassion and caring and inclusion, until every child is welcomed in life and protected by law.
Dr. Robert George is visiting professor at Harvard Law School and professor of jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program at Princeton University. He's a former member of the President's Council on Bioethics and co-author of the new book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. Dr. George, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you. Bye-bye.
When we come back, we're going to spend the second hour of the program with your answer, your reaction to a very interesting story we came across today. Some Roman Catholic parishes, and I imagine other churches are following suit but not making the headlines, in what is considered to be kind of an epidemic flu season, we're all hearing about that, are changing their worship practices on Sunday morning. Handshaking? No. Maybe going from a chalice to individual cups? In the case of Roman Catholic churches, not even offering the cup at all. I want your reaction to that. When we come back, it's audio, open lines issues, etc. on this Monday afternoon, January the 14th.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Does a Christian have a different reason for voting than a non-Christian? I've written an article for the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Vote for the Other Guy. You can read it by subscribing to the Issues Etc. journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. The latest journal also details Edie Wadsworth's journey from evangelical mysticism to the present tense gospel of the Reformation. Subscribe to the online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.